I don't know how long ago it was when Pastor Jin, John, and Laura approached me and talked about this idea of a collaboration with Ched and Elaine around the Mississippi watershed. And they said, who can we get to help speak to these issues? And I said, Sharon Day, without hesitation. And they said, okay, but if she's not available, I said, Sharon Day, there is no, she's not available. We have to have her come speak. And I'll get into introducing her more formally a little bit, but just please know if I can speak from the heart, Sharon, I'm very humbled that you would be here with us today. Great respecter of the work you've been doing for decades now. If I can recall us back to the end of our morning session, I see Tevin. I don't see Jay anywhere. He's skipping out. You know. But we concluded our session. There he is. We concluded our session with singing that old familiar spiritual, Wade in the Water. And everyone got up and they clapped and they sang along and there was celebration. And I sat in the back row and I wept. I wept. And afterwards I came up and I hugged Tevin and I said, I don't know what's going on, but I was moved to tears and I had time to think about it. That song, Wade in the Water. It's a song that calls us to the water for safety and refuge. And as I sat back there, I was brought to another time last year on the 4th of July. Several of us from this church spent that day up on Wounded Knee Hill in Pine Ridge. And we looked out over the field and we could see where Wounded Knee Creek ran in the distance, and an oral historian recalled for us the events that unfolded on that day in 1890, and how those women and children instinctively ran for the water, because we know in water there's safety. We are called to the water. Because there's safety, there's refuge. And I wept because that spiritual calls us to the water. It calls oppressed people to the water for liberation and safety. And all I could think of is our waters are not safe. They don't call us to refuge anymore. We warn people against our waters. There are signs in natural springs that flow from the earth. There are signs that say, don't drink this water. This water, which since the dawn of creation has flowed through this good earth, giving nourishment and life to all who would seek to drink it. All who are thirsty, come to the water and drink. And now there is a sign. Even if you're thirsty, do not drink. Sharon Day is a well-known Ojibwe woman. She's an award-winning artist and writer. To recall all of her works and that have been published would take a long time. I encourage you, please read over her bio in our packet and look at some of these works. If you are from the Twin Cities and you are at all concerned with watershed issues, you should already know who Sharon Day is. If not, and you're so fortunate, see if she'll accept your friend request on Facebook, because She accepted mine, and I feel special. There is a phenomenon going through Indian country around various watersheds, water walks, in which a group of people, sometimes a handful, sometimes a larger group, will walk the length of a river. And I believe it was in 2012 when Sharon and others walked the length of the Mississippi River from the headwaters to the Gulf of Mexico. And I just want you to know every day I offered prayers for your walk on that day and continue to do so. Sharon Day is one who hopes that for our children and grandchildren, one day again the waters would call us to safety and refuge and be safe for us once again. Would you please extend a very good welcome to Ms. Sharon Day.
Good afternoon. Bujun and Indwema Ganidug, Nagamo Maingan and Dishnakaz, Wabisheshi and Dodem, Ojibwe Kwein Dao, Nijo Madeo, Madewan Kwein Dao. So, what I said to you is greetings, my relatives. My name is Singing Wolf, although most people know me as Sharon Day. I'm from the Martin clan, and our clans are very important to us because they prescribe what our role in life is to be. And so the Wabasheshi or the Martin clan, if this were a lodge, it would face east to west. And the Wabasheshi, we sit at that western doorway. And we, our responsibility is to protect the people. So I've been very fortunate all of my adult life to work in jobs that allowed me to do that and protect the people. I also told you that I'm an Ojibwe woman, and the Ojibwe people. Now, we live in small villages, and originally lived on the eastern seaboard, and we migrated west based on prophecies. And there were seven of them, and they've all came true. But back then, one of the prophecies was that there will be people coming from across the ocean. You are to avoid contact with these people and move west until you come to a place where food grows on the water. That food is called manomen or wild rice. And they said that there certain things were going to happen. And they said that one day there would come a time where we wouldn't know our languages anymore, and that people would hardly recognize us to be Anishinaabe or Ojibwe people. And so I think back, like at that time, what must that have been like? Because they said, like, the Ojibwe, Potawatomi, Odawa, we were one people. And they called us people of the three fires. And they said that if you stood on a large elevation near the St. Lawrence Seaway and you looked south at night, you would see the campfires of the Ojibwe, the Odawa, and the Potawatomi people all the way down to the Carolinas. And so you think about that, like the huge, we are the third largest tribal people in North America. We live in five states. We have reservations in five states and in five provinces in Canada. So we are this large group of people. And so I think, like, well, what must that have been like for this, you know, large group of people to say, okay, we'll go west based on these prophecies? Because food was plentiful, right? Live on the northeast seaboard, and there's fish, deer, blueberries, a lot of the things that we have here. But you have all the seafood, right? But they did. They did move west, and they followed the Great Lakes, and live today in places where food grows on the water. So I also said that I'm second-degree Madewin, and Madewin is translates into English into something like the Grand Medicine Society. And to be Madewin is you have to do something to become Madewin. If I'm a Lutheran and I go to a Lutheran church, I can say that I'm Lutheran, right? But to be Madewin, you have to do more than just enter the doors. To be initiated, you have to learn certain things, and you have to go to ceremonies for a year, and then you have to make a bundle. And when you stand at that doorway, the grandmothers can look at you, and they can say, "Baka, wait. Perhaps you're not ready yet." And so I went to ceremonies for 17 years before I offered my Sema to become a Dewan. And I did that once in 1998 and then again in 2008. So what I said to you is I'm second degree Madewin. So when I went through the first time, I thought I'm really happy being first degree, because I never want to go through that again. But then, you know, I did. So, second degree Madewin. And so every degree, you know, you get a little more responsibility, so that's the way that works. The image that you see is a Madewin-style teaching lodge. And everything that I know about the water and about the ceremonies that we do when we do a water walk comes from the Madewin Lodge. When I was a little kid, I used to ask my dad, because he would draw these stories on the ground in the sand, and he would say, you know, this is where we came from. This is who we are. And then he'd do one of these stories, and then he didn't have a drum, but he had an Arco coffee can, and he'd turn it upside down, and then he'd sing, and we'd all dance, you know. And so I would ask him, well, who are the Madewin? And he'd say, well, they're the medicine people. Yes, but who are they? They're the people who take care of the people. Well, how do you get to be Madewin? Oh, you have to be invited. Well, how do you get invited? You have to have a good moral character. That's what he said. And so that's why it took me 17 years. But everything that I know about the ceremonies comes from the Madewin Lodge, and I want to acknowledge that. In the lodge, so if this were a lodge, sometimes there's a prescribed seating. And when there is prescribed seating, the men sit on one side and the women sit on this side. But instead of looking forward, we look at each other, right? So we sit facing each other. And so even when the men are sitting on one side and the women are sitting on the other side, you can see that, like, the lodge is clearly divided between the men and the women. And so we all have our responsibilities. The women have theirs and the men have theirs. And so women are responsible for the water. And I think it's always been that way. And it's that way in other cultures as well. Women are always the ones who go and gather the water. when I was a little kid on the Boys Fort Reservation, and when we finally had water, there were three wells, and they were situated in different places on the reservation. And the first thing that we would do in the morning is you go to the pump closest to you, and you bring the water. And when we left there, we moved to a place called Sand Lake, and we lived on a farmhouse. And there was a well out halfway across the field. And the first thing we did in the morning was go and get the water, and the last thing at night. And I remember going with my older sister to gather the water, and I remember there was like the Northern Lights. The ground was really, the snow was hard and crunchy, and so you could hear and you could see your breath, and the Northern Lights were. And I asked my sister, you know, like, well, what are those lights? And she said, they're spirits dancing in the sky. But anyhow, so we gathered the water, first thing in the morning, last thing at night. And I think that's true in many cultures. Men are responsible for other things, and mostly making the fire. And so as we gather the water, we have like certain ceremonies that we do. And we don't just go and get the water, but, you know, you make that offering, sema, and there's a gentleman who offered me a sema when I got here. And so, but you know, that's what they always say, like, beja go a sema first. So before you do anything, you offer that a sema. And so that's our responsibility. And men do the same thing, but I don't quite know their ceremonies. So in 1998, there was, how many of you remember the Camp Coldwater? So there's a spring, and it's called Camp Coldwater, and the city and the county and the state wanted to widen Hiawatha, because they said if they widened it and they made it straighter, there would be less accidents and less traffic delay. Have any of you ever driven down Hiawatha at 4 o'clock or 9, 8 o'clock in the morning? Well, you sit at every light, right? A couple times? Well, anyhow, so much for improving the traffic delay. But when they were going to widen that road, it was going to make that road be 200 feet from Camp Coldwater. And so that spring comes up through the limestone, and it's purified through the limestone as it comes up. And for many years, it had been behind fences because the U.S. Department of Mines had buildings there, and so nobody had access to it. And so finally, when the U.S. Mines moved out and the buildings were still there, but the spring was there, you know, the people started to go there. And but they took all those houses by eminent domain. And anyhow, so the Dakota people who were there, and this is where they believe they came into the sacred place, they came into the world, they asked for help from the Madewin people. And so I remember it was December 6th, 1998, we were called to go there. So I live in Highland Park. I've lived there probably 30 years. So I often walk my dog along Mississippi River Boulevard on the east side of the river. Up until 1998, I had never set foot on the west side of the river. Because as I would walk my dog, especially at twilight, on the east side of the river, you could hear, and you know, it was like sometimes you could hear, you know, crying. It was always like sadness, you know, coming from and that side of the river. So I never ever went there. When we were called to go there, we had a pipe ceremony in one of the houses, and the chief of the Three Fires Madewan Lodge, Eddie Benton Benet, he said to us, when the Dakota people were interned at Fort Snelling, and there were babies that were born there, and there were babies that died there, and there were women and children that died there, and they need to be remembered, and that's why this is a sad place. And so, you know, what he said was what I had always felt walking along and the east side of the river at twilight, right? And so that began, that was the first time that the Madewan people took our ceremonies outside of the Madewan Lodge and into a geopolitical situation. And so my sister and I were involved with Camp Coldwater then for probably the next 2.5 years, and were eventually arrested for for being civilly obedient. So, you know, what the chief said to us that night was, he said, "What will you do for the water? What will you do for the water?" And there was a grandmother, Josephine Mandam, and she heard him say that too. "What will you do for the water?" And so while we were being involved with trying to save Camp Coldwater the spring, she went through her house, and she lives up in Thunder Bay, and she got rid of all the chemicals, cleaning products, and learned how to conserve and preserve the water. And she came upon a man who said to her, "I had a dream about women with long skirts, and when we're in ceremony, we wear long skirts, walking around the lake, Lake Superior, and they were carrying, you know, this copper pail." And so Josephine said to herself, "I can do that." And so she came to the lodge, and she said, "This is what I'm going to do." And so then we were able to help her get going, and then women walked with her, and I walked with her when she was near Sault Ste. Marie in Canada. And so we did that, and then Josephine walked around all the rest of the Great Lakes, having women join her, and women and men, and she made those journeys around all the lakes. And then in 2010, there was a young woman who had a dream. I have to tell you, like, for Ojibwe people, our dreams are so very important for us. And I think it's a little bit like meditating. You know, when you meditate, you've all had that experience, right, where you're thinking about something, you have a problem, and just before you're ready to fall asleep, it's like, aha, you know, there's an answer. Of course, then in the morning you wake up and it's like, well, what was that? Well, I forgot what I was going to say. Where is that going with that? Huh? A woman had a dream. A young woman, and she said she had this dream of women coming from the four oceans to what we call the heart of Turtle Island, Lake Superior. And so when somebody has a dream, you know, like we make life decisions based on those dreams, because we feel like that time, that dream world, and that time just before meditating, just before, sometimes when we fall asleep even, that's when we're, you know, like we sort of, our ego gets out of the way, right? And so their dreams are very important. And so Grandmother Josephine said, "Let's do that. Let's bring that healing salt water from the four oceans to Lake Superior." And I have family that lives in Washington. I really would have loved to walk, but somebody volunteered immediately for that western, bringing the water from the Pacific And Josephine said, and I'm bringing it from the north. And somebody else volunteered for the East Coast, and all that was left was the South. Now, if you look at the map of the United States, you know, all the Indians had been removed west of the Mississippi, right? So if you look from, like, Gulfport, Mississippi, straight north, you don't, you know, there's some Choctaws over there in Mississippi, and kind of in the southeast right corner of the state. But from there, there are no tribal people in left in Mississippi other than the Choctaws there and Tennessee. You know, those folks were all moved. In Arkansas, there are no Indians there. Missouri. So you don't get to any Indian people until you get to Wisconsin. Nobody volunteered. Anyhow, finally I said I would do it. And so I led that walk. And this picture is of Gulfport, Mississippi, the day that we started. So we started on April 21st, 2011. And here, and when we left, we wore fleece jackets. And when we got there and the day we started walking, it was 80 degrees and humidity was about the same. And Grandmother Josephine hurt her knee. She was there to get us started, and she hurt her knee right away, and so she couldn't walk very well. So there was myself and my niece, who was 19. So I was 59, Josephine was 69, and my niece was 19. And Josephine couldn't walk very much, so mostly me and my niece walked for the first 10 days. And then my family came and joined me and walked for a couple days and left. So that walk... it was very difficult physically and mentally and emotionally. And I happen to be the executive director of the Indigenous Peoples Task Force. So when I volunteered to coordinate this walk, I thought, I'll go down there, I'll get it started, and then I'll walk a little bit, and then I'll come home, and I'll do some work, and then I'll go back and check on them and, you know... Then about 4 days into the walk, Josephine said to me one morning, she said, Sharon, I had this realization. When we took this water from the Gulf, we orphaned it. You know, like we took this water from its home, and now we're going to take it all the way to Lake Superior. And who knows how long it will take for that water to get back home again. And so she said this with, like, you know, very serious and very, you know, like, I had this realization. And so when we got to Memphis, took us about 14 days to get to Memphis. In Memphis, there's no way to get across the Mississippi that's not a freeway. So we had to portage the water from Memphis to across the Mississippi. And Mississippi's big there. I mean, like, this was like a couple mile portage, right? And so I'm holding this copper pail on my lap, and all of a sudden I had this realization that we've orphaned this water. We took this water from its home, and once we get to Lake Superior, who knows how long it's going to take this water to get back home. And so, therefore, it's my responsibility to make sure that this water gets to Lake Superior. And I never left that water until it got to Lake Superior. 2011, there was lots of flooding. This is in Mississippi, and you can see, you know, the water, the Mississippi looks very different there. There was... while we were walking in Iowa, they blew up a dike. They blew up a dike because if they didn't blow it up, it was going to flood a town further downstream. And so you know, when you build these dikes and you make the water stay in this channel, you know, what's meant to happen is for when a river overflows, there are wetlands along the river, right? And those wetlands are like sponges, and they absorb the water. But if you build this dike, you're forcing the river into doing something that's not natural. So that happened on that walk. Here we are, and we're getting to June 11th, Bad River, Wisconsin. It was about 42 days later, and somebody took this picture, and we are now have the water from those four oceans, and we're going out in a boat from those four oceans, the Pacific, the Hudson Bay, the Atlantic, and the, we're taking it out on the river, I mean, out into the lake. And then Joseph Spurrier and Josephine said, again, who knows how long it'll take for these waters to get back to their home. And when we poured that water into Lake Superior, I cried. We were very sad. Why was that? And I said, well, it's a young 18 years of age when he went off to college. And when he left, I took him to his dorm, bought him groceries, got him all set in, and he said to me, Grandma, don't cry when you leave. Grandma, don't cry. So I didn't. I got up. And I thought, why am I crying? Because this is the way it's supposed to be. We're supposed to raise these children, and they're supposed to go away from us, right? And but you know you're going to miss them. You know that you're going to miss them. And that's how I felt about that water. For 42 days, or thereabouts, I think it was something like that. For 42 days, I carried this water. And who knows how long it was going to take that water to get back to the ocean. But what conversations those waters from those four oceans were going to have as they made their journey back. To know that there are still some people who care about the water. After, on that Mother Earth water walk, the most important ceremony of the day was who was going to bandage my feet in the morning so I could walk. I had a blister after blister, and at one point Josephine said to me about the seventh day, you can't walk. Look at your feet. They're like traumatized. They were swollen and the, so many blisters. And so she and my niece walked, and about after their second time out, Josephine gets into the little RV and she says, Sharon, what are we going to do? I said, I'm going to walk. And so I had taken some ibuprofen, worked pretty good, and I walked. And there were days where one of my clients I had known for 20 years died while I was gone. And I think I was in Missouri. And that was really hard. You know, Fred, I'd known him for so long. And one of the grandmothers, the first grandmother who gave me the first contribution for the walk, Zona, she died. And but I couldn't leave that water. I had to stay with that water. So emotionally and physically, it was so difficult. But as we got into Wisconsin, and there were days where like it was just me and one other person, right? And there were days when else would drive, you know, like all night to get to me the next morning to help me walk. But as we got to Wisconsin, I started to think, had this crazy, no, there's not going to be a next, you know. But then, I mean, you weren't with me all the way, right? I'm the only one. Only one who walked every day. There was no Saturday or Sunday. What do you mean? What are we going to do next? But then I still kept having that thought. That, well, why don't we walk part of the Mississippi? Well, so we walked in 2013. We walked the Mississippi River March 1st because I already been in the South, right? Like, I know how I. So we said we'd start on March 1st, and that way I figured we'd get, well, we got there on May 5th, I believe. But this was the weather. It was beautiful, and because there were various walks. And the day as we walked into Grand Rapids, the wind was blowing in our face. This wind was blowing straight into our face. So I text Josephine, petitioned to Key Wade. He said, I will right away. So when we left Grand Rapids, that north wind was at our back. Flakes were coming down. It was one of the most beautiful days of our walk. These are all the Mississippi River. We've seen these beautiful eagles at Prairie Island. And the animals, the horses, when they would see us coming, these horses would come running up to us. They'd call us. They'd do a little dance in a circle, and they'd walk along beside us. And it's really beautiful. This is a confluence of the Wisconsin River and the Mississippi River. We were up on in bluff. We had a beautiful pipe ceremony there. And whenever I see this, I think, this is why we walk. Monk's Mound in Cahokia, we had a water ceremony there. And when we got to the top, we cleaned our copper vessel beautifully. And so we had fresh water. When we left the headwaters, we had water in the pail, but we also filled, a big jug of water from the headwaters, because there would be evaporation, right, and so on. And so we wanted to make sure we had that water when we got to Louisiana. And so we had a water there, and we offered the people there in St. Louis a drink of the water. And they're really scared to drink it, because they can't imagine drinking the Mississippi River water. They'd smell it, and they're like, no, go ahead. This is from the headwaters. But that was climbing up the steps to Monk's Mound. This is Ira Johnson. He walked with me the whole way. What it looks like down in between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. The day before we got to New Orleans, the air was so, the blossoms and from the trees, the air was so fragrant, like medicine. And then we get to Baton Rouge, and then all you can smell is methane, this is what it looks like. And you can see that flame 20 miles away. And they call that Cancer Alley. This is a picture of Josephine and a young walker in New Orleans. And we're about to get on a ferry. We ferried across the bay. And this picture I took from the St. Paul, or the Sunday paper in New Orleans. And there are 29 places that no longer exist. And so you can see, like, the levee system, Pilot Town, you can no longer get there other than by boat. We ended our walk just a couple miles north of Venice. But when you get down there, you see these... not only is there the levee system, but all those oil refinery companies that are there, and there's a refinery for every gasoline company in the world. They built these, you can see them, sorry, they look like veins. Rather than go around, it used to all be land, right, and go up the main levee system, they built these channels, so they'd have easier access. And what happened with Katrina was New Orleans is 80 miles from the mouth, 80 or 90 miles from the mouth. So you think, like, how does that ocean water get 80 or 90 miles up, right? It's because these levee systems and these channels provided... it's sort of like when you're kids and you build a little Any of you do that? Build little roads and you pour water and you'd see where the water would go. Well, when there was that hurricane, it just, those channels made perfect systems for that water to get to New Orleans. And they say they lose like 100 yards every day of land. And when we met with the Huma people there, tribal people, you know, and they're people who used to, from time began, they were people who fished. And now they can't do that anymore. Because everything that we do here, we send downstream. And that's what creates that dead zone. So they can't fish anymore because of and the BP oil spill and Katrina. We had a very small RV, and in those RV camps in 2013, there are the RV parks. They only have about 5 daily openings because all of the rest of those RV sites are filled with people who live there permanently. Now, these aren't poor people of color. These are white folks who were displaced since Katrina. And then this is Barb. And the last day, they're running with the water. And so that started off that morning. They were running. It was beautiful sunshine. And an hour later, we only had like 5 miles to go that day. An hour later, it's just the rain is just coming down. And this young woman works at a St. Jude's Hospital in Memphis and wrote a beautiful story about the children they see at St. Jude's are coming from Louisiana and Mississippi, where we've seen all those refineries. They call it Cancer Alley. Her children, when we walk through where you've seen that picture of Wisconsin and the Minnesota confluence, there was a park ranger there at Effigy Bear Mounds Park. Have any of you ever been there? Yeah, a couple of people. I really urge you to go there. It's a nice day trip. It's right on the northeast corner of Iowa, but there's a bluff, and Prairie du Chien is on the other side of the road, but it's a beautiful national park system. And the park ranger gave me these two tiny little turtles, and he said, I'd like to see these turtles sunning on the banks of the Mississippi and Louisiana. This woman, when we were going through Memphis, we got a phone call, and then somebody said, there's a woman coming with her two children, and they want to meet you. Well, it rained all day. And when I told you, like, from the north, you know, the north wind was at our back, it changes. So around some southern Missouri, the wind switches. And so then you're walking into that south wind. Now, the south wind is not the north wind, but it is steady. And every day we walked straight into this wind. And so we say, you know, like from the four directions that the winds, you know, they each bring you something. Each direction has teachings that go along with it. And so after about 2 weeks of walking into this south wind every day, I said to Zhaowenung, is how we say that southerly direction. So I started to put tobacco down every day, Bejigo Sema, right? And I'd say, Zhaowenung Noden, what is it that you're trying to tell me? By the time we were Mississippi, it was like, what? Just tell me, I'll do it. Anyhow, so we had been walking into the south wind, And they said, there's somebody coming, and she wants to bring her children. And so these two young children came, and we'd been raining all day, and we had that, not only the rain, but the wind and the rain in our face. And so we stopped about 5 o'clock, and a car pulls up behind us. And it was this woman, her two children came, and they said, we have something for you. We danced at a powwow this weekend, and we won, and we wish to give you a gift for the walk. And so they each put something in my hand, and I opened my hand. These kids not only gave me part of their winnings, they gave me all of their winnings. So each 10-year-old, 11-year-old, they each gave me a $100 bill. So I went in the RV to see, like, what do I have to give these kids, right? And there are those two little turtles, pipestone turtles, hanging on the visor that the park ranger had said, I want to see these in New Orleans. Well, I thought, perfect for these young people. So I gave them to them. But anyhow, she came back and joined us that last day. And here we are at Fort Jackson. It's still raining. Here's Josephine, drove down and joined us. And as you can see, it's raining. When we took that water and we poured it into the Mississippi, when we gathered it at the headwaters, it was, we drank that water, right? And as we walked out of the Itasca State Park, that water started to freeze in the pail. And it froze in a circular manner. And that water was so, we drank it. And as we talked about it, I had had a dream the night before about, like, you know, seeing like these old Indians on the other side of, you know, that little waterway there. And, you know, they were looking to the east. And as we prayed that morning, there were 7 swans that flew overhead. And I am in recovery. I didn't have a very long drinking and drugging history, enough to get into quite a bit of trouble. But I quit drinking and using any drugs when I was 21 the first time and 23 the last time. And when we took that water out, you know, it was like, this is the way we all come into the world, pure and clean, with only gifts. But if, like me, you end up being an addict, alcoholic, we've given away most of our gifts. But we can get them back. And as I, every day that I was in recovery, I got some of my gifts back, right? I traded some anger for kindness. I traded some hate for love. But the river, she's like us, pure and clean. But we pollute her. I polluted myself. But we pollute the river. And we're the only one that can unpollute her. And so when we poured that water into the river, we wanted the river at the mouth to have a taste of what she began as, pure and clean. And we said to her, this is how you were, and this is how we wish for you to be again. And when we poured that water in there, I guess there was probably a boat going by, but the river, there was a wave that came over our ankles, and then another one that came to our shins, and then another one that came to our knees. There were 4 of them, and we all just stood there, and it was like being kissed by the river. And this is the Mississippi River, where I have water ceremony every Sunday morning, 9 o'clock, Hidden Falls. Anybody's welcome to join. So when I came back, some people called me and they said, you know, gosh, we're really having problems at Seneca Lake. They want to make a LP gas storage in an old salt cavern. What can you tell us? So I told them some things, and the next morning they called me up and they said, you know, would you come and lead this walk? And so I did. And this was the people who walked with me all around Seneca Lake. It was 80 miles, 2013. And then after we walked, after the Mississippi River, that was 65 days and 1,285 miles or something like that. That's it. I'm done. And then Barb Bakler Rush said, well, what are we going to do next? No, we're not. No. No, there is no next. Who do you know that has walked from the southern border of the United States to the northern border and then walked the Mississippi all the way? Who do you know that's done that? I mean, surely that's enough. And then we were at a meeting, and Barb said, I have a gift for you. And I opened it up, and it was an eagle head. She said, this is for the staff. And I said, I guess our work isn't done. We knew that walking the Mississippi River, that the biggest polluter of the Mississippi River is the Ohio River. And we walked the Ohio River. And this was one of the most beautiful places that we were, the Great Serpent Mound. We had a pipe ceremony there one night. This is barges and barges of coal go up and down the river. This is what we saw. So I have asthma, and I had to call my doctor and get a course of prednisone, because this is what we walk through. There are coal mines, coal-burning plants on the river, sharing a parking lot with a nuclear power plant. And across the river is an RV camp. And some Ojibwe women joined us in Covington, Kentucky, and my friend Roxanne Ornelas, who used to be here in Minneapolis, teaching at the U, is now teaching in Miami University. And then here we are at Fort Defiance, the confluence of the Ohio and Mississippi River. And people who walked with us from Memphis and St. Louis joined us again on the end of the Ohio. And they also walked, some of them walked with me in 2011. And then we came home, and then there's all this information that we know about sulfide mining that they're proposing. And so we walked the St. Louis River. And this is a beautiful river. Where I grew up on the Iron Range. This is still, this is still up in the air. Please, if you can, if you don't want to see the things that I saw in Ohio, the land, the air quality, the water, we really must stop sulfide mining. And what I say to people is, we have to tell our legislators here, because it's going to have to be the legislators in the southern half of the state who say no to sulfide mining, the same way that we said no to when they wanted to open up the boundary waters, right, to boating and all those other things. People in the south said no. So we have to say no to that. But then we have to say yes to creating economic development that's sustainable on the Iron Range. This was a picture that I took with my iPhone the day before and this is a lake near Hoyt Lakes. It's not a river, but it was so beautiful. I was driving north, and I looked in my rearview mirror, and I seen this beautiful image. So I pulled over and took this. No matter how wonderful any artist is, nobody can compare to the creator. And this is St. Louis near Cloquet. And these are, I should have switched those. This should have came first. But this is what it looks like in Virginia. If you go up on that big thing and you look down the mining lookout, that's mining dumps. And those rivers are created by the taconite pellets. And here we are at the end at the Fond du Lac Reservation. purchase Spirit Island, and the tribal chair said to me, she said, people say, why did you purchase that? Why did you purchase that island? Because it's a Superfund site. And she said, because it's a sacred place to us on the migration, and we need to clean it up. Chippewa River Water Walk, April 2015. Again, it's light snowing, beautiful. This is at the Winter Dam. And Barb Baker LaRush and her granddaughters, my niece and Joe Cruz, he wrote a great story about that walk. And these young women have walked with me several times, and we're just having a water ceremony, but they walk with me, and they run. And when they come, I'm so happy, because if we're behind, you know, they help us get caught up. And this is the James River. When we were walking the Ohio River, Diane Stevenson, on the day she left, she walked with us for 2 weeks. On the day she left, there was an image of, some of you may have seen it in the news, of a train near Lynchburg, Virginia, that train slid off, and there was a fire, and it looked like the river was on fire, and it was an oil train. And Diane said, "You know, we have to walk the James River." So we did. And this is Vicki Ferguson and her adopted daughter, and they walked us through their tribal lands. It was beautiful. And here you see upstate, you know, no pipelines, as we see this all over, right? This is just a, you know, I think this was in Lynchburg. We just seen the sign by this, so of course we had to take a picture. Tobacco drying houses, and I could talk about tobacco too, but I won't. This could be any walk, right? We see these all over. This is my friend Perf Fay, and she's just a quick story. When we started walking, Perf Fay is an international recording artist, and so she spends most of her time in planes, and as a result of that, has poor circulation in her legs, and so when she first started walking, it was very hard. But here we are, 7 or 8 days down, and she's running. And this has happened to quite a few people who've walked with me, came with canes, and after a while, you know, it's sort of like use it or lose it, you know. And but anyhow, she's running here, and I told her, you know, you have to keep this up. So the James River, I thought I knew what colonization meant, being a native person. On the highway, you see these signs, you know, sort of glorifying the first gave them food, then they killed us. In here again, you know, I don't even know what to say about these. But this is what we do every day, you know, like we start and where we end, we make a circle on the ground, we offer our sema, and we say, Gijadage sema. And what that means is like, wait right here. And we'll be back. And so then we know where to start the next morning. And so I love that, you know, on every river we've walked, there are, who knows how long they'll stay there, right? But there are these circles. For every day that we walk, there's a circle someplace. This is Hampton, Virginia. This is the second to the last day of the walk. As you can see, it's raining. It rained all day. There's a little pattern there. And when we poured the water in the Chesapeake Bay, these dolphins came. And they, we could hear them. And then we walked the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland, and the Cuyahoga River some years ago was on fire. And in 2014, I drove out there and made our offering and made our declaration. And then here we are in 2015 walking. Cuyahoga River. And our final ceremony, it's raining. Then the Seneca Lake folks called me up and they said, could you come back again? We're still dealing with the same issue. Can you come back? And so came back. And this is a sign that we've seen over there. Talking again about, they don't say like that, you know, the whole village was wiped out. And here we are at the east end of the walk. There's always giveaways. A little art, you know, we try to do. And here we are at the Tar Sands Resistant March earlier this summer. We led that march. And you can't see it, but this is a beautiful rainbow over Lake Mille Lacs. Seeing that. But this is why we walk, right? This is why we walk. I guess that's it. To be given teachings by many people, be with Dr. Emoto and about 2 summers ago, and what he's, you know, the great mystery is water. You know, like, and I had asked somebody this on one of the walks too, like, why is it that ice floats? And they said, oh, you know, you have to have a certain volume of water and then the ice will float, right? But why is the ice lighter than the water? You know, like what? And Dr. Emoto said that too. He said, why is it that ice freezes on the top? If it froze from the bottom, there would be no life. And he said, I think that God is in the water. And I think that's maybe true, because without water, there would be no life. Do you have any questions?
Thank you for being with us. Many of us have been hearing about these water walks and the way this movement is spreading around North America. So it's very inspiring that you're here. Do you publicize your walks beforehand? And are you looking for collaborators and people to accompany or not?
Yeah.
And how do your water walks, how's the various water walking movements happening around North America, how are they relating to each other, if at all?
So, Josephine Serta does Canada, and there are other walks as well there. And I've been sort of doing the river walks in the States. We have a website called nebiwalk.org, and people can go there, and it's not probably as updated as often as we should. We collaborate with, on the Chippewa River Walk, that was the University of Wisconsin at Eau Claire called me up about 9 months ahead of time and said, we'd like to do this next spring. And part of the environmental program they have. And so we met and worked things out. On the James River Walk, it was the James River Water Association. They handled all of the mapping and the lodging, and we rafted part of that river. Cuyahoga Walk, there was an organization called Bright Water Rising, along with a church there, Trinity Lutheran Church. And there were a number of things that happened. There was an art gallery, and there was a podcast that was made for the came out of their church. Various things that happened there. So that was with Bright Water Rising, and Seneca Lake was collaborated with. We Are Seneca Lake. Then the next walks that I have coming up are the Minnesota River next spring. And I'll be doing like a series of workshops, and probably beginning in February, do one local here, one out west. And the Minnesota River, as you probably know, is, if you took an aerial shot of the Mississippi River, it's pretty good until the Minnesota River joins it. And then you have a lot of agricultural runoff that's creating high levels of nitrites. And then when you look at some of the chemicals that are in the fertilizers, triclosan plus chlorine equals dioxins. And so, of course, we have wastewater treatment plants where they use chlorine. And so that's what we're sending downstream. And the Minnesota River really, you know, is so, has so much agricultural runoff. And we know this year that there was no swimming in lakes in southwestern Minnesota. So we really, it's beyond time for some things that need to happen with the Minnesota River. So we'll be walking the Minnesota River next year. We don't have any collaborators yet, but that's a walk that I'll organize. And then the Missouri in 2017. I think there's so many issues with Missouri, but those are the next two walks that I'm planning and that I'll be organizing. Anybody who wishes to work with us, we publicize it on the website. If you just ever like Google my name, you'll see we work with many newspapers, radio. We've done as much, but we're grassroots, so it all happens because through some kind of grace, I guess.
Mm-hmm. This is actually the first time that I've heard about these water walks, and I'm sure some people are already familiar, but I was wondering what kind of impact or long-term or short-term impact do you see coming out of these walks?
So we really support like all of the other environmental work that takes place and the work of the science people and the 350 and all those folks. And what we see, but what we don't see as part of those efforts is that spiritual base. And one of the things that I learned on that first walk that was so very difficult was if, you know, people would say to me, like, did you ever think about quitting? Absolutely not. And so what I learned is that if you have a spiritual basis for what you're doing, it doesn't matter how difficult it is emotionally, physically, or mentally, you can reach your goal, right? And so we really see that is what's missing from all these other movements. We support their work, but we also see that that basis of that spiritualness is missing. So love is the healing grace, right? So I'm Ojibwe. You know that I'm a woman. I'm a two-spirit woman, or I'm a lesbian. And I grew up my whole life resisting racism, sexism, and classism, the war in Vietnam, the war, all the other wars since then. I spent my whole life resisting something. And what I learned on that first walk was, for every action, there's a reaction. And so when you push, right, you push at something, people push back. So what I want to spend the rest of my life doing is being like that river, flowing in a sacred direction. With love, because love is the healing grace. And I want to take as many people along with me as I can. So I'm not going to spend any more energy in protesting. When they asked me to do that tar sands resistance, they asked me to lead a water ceremony, and I did. And then to carry the water to the Capitol, which I did. But if I'm going to be walking any place, it's going to be carrying that water with me, right? Because love is the healing grace.
Well, you can see how fortunate enough we are to have Sharon with us this afternoon, because it's on any given day, it's just as likely she's walking alongside a river someplace carrying a copper pail. You put a lot of miles on those feet, and I know the people of Turtle Island are very grateful for your work. Extend heartfelt gratitude, and I would ask, as we conclude this time with Sharon, that we would extend our gratitude to her. Thank you.
You know, so all of our work is like grassroots, and but I do have, you know, artists and, you know, they're always at the forefront of any movement, right? And so I've been fortunate to have a number of musicians walk with me, and you know, I've composed a few songs too along the way. So we have this Nebe Walk River Songs. One of our walkers works at Fond du Lac Community College, and so we were able to get about 8 of us together, and we went there and last December, and we just stood around a mic and sang, and then a couple of people gave us songs, and so it's all on this. It's $20. It supports the walk, and I have a few with me. So, you go ahead.
Sharon, just one other quick thing. We mentioned this last night, but I wonder if you could just say a few words about Sister Mississippi.
Yes.
This was Sharon gifted us this to us for the weekend, yeah. And it's amazing.
Yeah.
So.
So the River Sister River Project, there was a woman who grew up in Minneapolis and lives in Mexico City right now, but she's a textile artist, and she put out a call. She called me up, we talked about it, and so while we were walking the Mississippi River, women from 77 different women made these prayer panels, and my staff took them over to the Elders Lodge in St. Paul, and then the Elders, and when I read, it was really incredible. Women from women who made these panels, and so while we were walking, absolutely incredible to me, reached people all over the world, effect of what you did or what you do. And I had women, you know, that put love about the water. And every Sunday, up and down, walkers, wherever they are, at whatever body of water they're in. And I tell people who walk with me, it's really in walking. That's where that transformation takes place, right? It's a physical thing. It's when you're walking and it's 80 degrees, so much, right? And so the walk is only the beginning. What do you do for the water? And so, you know, these women in groups going to their local county board, because that's where those decisions get made, a few years ago, as we walked around it, it had a big gouge in it. you know, it was fresh, right? Trees had grown up, and all of a sudden there was fresh here. What is this? And they said, we don't know, but we'll find out. And so then they, going into those tailing dumps, so, you know, the earth kind of takes care of herself. You know, but what they're doing is they're taking the nuggets, they're mining the nuggets from those nuggets. Now, I only know one way to do that, and that is with chemicals. Board meetings, and we're going to sit there, and we're going to find out what's happening. On the Chippewa River, city councils, that's when, you know, in the EPA process, we have mines in northern 20 years ago, and they're still operating on the same permits, and that till they get a new permit. But because the EPA is so backlogged, who knows when that'll happen, and respond to it, then they get it by default. And so, wrong. But it's at those local levels that those decisions get made. What do we do? You know, what do we do on a daily basis? And those things are tedious, right? Who wants to go sit at a county board meeting, you know? But that is where those decisions get made, and that's where we have to be, where we have to place our bodies and our minds and our mouths. Okay, miigwech.
Thank you. For those who...